Well, turn with me tonight to the book of Ruth. As we're on week 25 of our journey through the Old Testament in our D-Life groups. And so that brings us to the book of Ruth. And it's good this week. We're going to do the whole book of Ruth. We're not going to do all of it tonight. And I'll probably mention this again Sunday, but one of my favorite little stories about the book of Ruth is that Benjamin Franklin was part of a literary group when he was the ambassador to France. And they would meet and talk about great literary works. And so one day, he decided to read the book of Ruth as his literary contribution to his group. And but he wanted to kind of, he knew some of them were real negative about the Bible, so not wanting to mess up his story, he changed the name so that they wouldn't necessarily recognize it, and then read the book of Ruth, and they began to discuss it with different names, and they decided it was one of the greatest love stories they had ever heard, one of the greatest short stories ever written. And then he told him, well, it's the book of Ruth out of the Bible. But that was always one of my favorite stories about the book of Ruth outside of circles. Our memory verse for the week is one you probably know, probably not from its context of a daughter-in-law talking to her mother and the family that they had connected. And that's what we're going to really talk about tonight. But it's one you hear in weddings all the time. And that's... We find there, and where Ruth says, "But urge me not to leave you or to turn back from you, for where you go, I will go; where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." So that's our memory verse for the week. And we're gonna look at the story as a whole Sunday when I preach and focus a lot on chapter 4. But tonight I thought we would just kind of look at the book and really this first chapter. So if you'll turn there with me, Ruth chapter 1. When we find it, of course, in our Bible after the book of Judges, and that's where it appears in the Septuagint. In the Hebrew Bible, it's in the back part of the Bible in what we would call the writings. And it's part of five books that are put together that the Hebrew Bible calls the Megaloth. And they are five books that are associated with the different festivals of the Jewish faith. And those five books are, by the way, the Song of Solomon, which is associated, interestingly enough, with the festival of Passover, and the book of Ecclesiastes, which is associated with the Feast of Tabernacles, the book of Lamentations, which is associated with the ninth of Ab, and then the book of Esther, which is associated with the Festival of Purim, which celebrates the story of Esther. But the book of Ruth is associated with what the Hebrews called the Feast of Weeks. And the Feast of Weeks is the first harvest festival. And you probably know that by the name that we use from the New Testament and that we call Pentecost. And so remember, Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit fell and Peter preached and those 2,000 people were saved, corresponded with the Jewish festival of the first harvest. And of course, that was the first harvest of preaching of the gospel after Christ had died and been resurrected. And so it very appropriately fit with that springtime, that first harvest. And so that's what the book of Ruth was associated with. And you'll see as we read and study this book this week and Sunday that it deals a lot with harvest. And so that's probably why that association would occur.
Brother Kingman, you mentioned Lamentations is what? The ninth of what?
The ninth of Ab.
Okay.
And Ab is one of the Jewish months, but the ninth of Ab is the celebration of the, actually the lamenting of the destruction of the temple. And so in 587, 586, when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, that happened on the ninth of Ab. And interestingly enough, when Titus would destroy it in 70 AD, destroy Herod's temple, it would be roughly that same day, the eighth or ninth of Ab is when that happened. And so today when they celebrate that or mourn that, it's the destruction of both of those temples. But that's what it was associated with. The same date, I don't know historically if that was Titus's motivation of when to do it or it's just when it happened. But for them, they celebrate both on that same day. And so
intentional by God.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's a good way to put it, Bob. Thank you. Yeah, and so. So that's when that happened. So 9th of Ab, 586 B.C., Solomon's temple was destroyed. 9th of Ab, 70 A.D., Herod's temple was destroyed. So that was the destruction of the temple. All right, let's look at this first chapter together and talk through some of it. So when he begins with this time of transition, and see if this... there are days that this fits with us, and it begins this way, verse 1. In the days when judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. And the man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. And the names of their two sons were Malchon and Chilion, and they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. So the first thing you see is this time of transition, and we've all been there when you're going to move, when you're going to move to a new location. And so I can see Elimelech coming home and telling his family they're going to move from Bethlehem to Moab. And the reason they were going to move is because there was a famine that was making it hard to develop food, which is and the wheat that is there in Bethlehem. Now what is interestingly about that is Bethlehem, in Hebrew, Beth means house, Lechem means bread. So the name of Bethlehem literally means house of bread, and yet he's saying there is no bread there, and so we've got to go elsewhere to look for bread. And so they move from Bethlehem to Moab, and that's a tough change, a tough relocation, and you know, we are reminded in our own life that transitions are inevitable. You know, Dale Huff used to say, the only thing that doesn't change is that everything changes. And so we're always dealing with transitions in life, that no person stays the same, nothing stays the same. There's always change from school to marriage to job to retirement to location, to all of those things that impact us and that we deal with. So transitions are something that we have to deal with, and there's often a lot of trauma that is involved in tension, whether good or bad, in those relocations, in those changes in life. You end up in a strange land, in a strange house. You have... Even when it's good things happening, a baby being born or a new job, all of those still bring anxiety and tension to our life. And so I'm sure that was true for Elimelech and Naomi and their sons. And you know, when you think about those things, you think about things like fear and loneliness and depression and loss and grief. And so we see those difficulties of transition, but yet there are important resources that we need when we face those transitions in life. And one of those is family. And so family is important. And so we see that here, that they're moving as a family together, mom and dad and two sons. And so they have each other. They have that support group. And that's why church is so important as family, that we need to be aware of, that we ourselves are going through transitions constantly, but all the people that we come into contact with have transitions going on in their life. And, they have situations of sickness. They have situations of other things that are going on that are challenges to them. And that's why church family is so important that we love each other and we care for each other. And since I mentioned Dr. Huff, I'll mention this. You've heard me say it many times. One of my favorite things he ever did is said, look at the person on your left. Look at the person on your right. They have needs in their life. That's why you need to pray for them. That's why you need to love on them. And so that's why we need each other. And so we see that transition that they're going for, and they move to this foreign land. So here now we watch them as they deal with this transition. And so look then at verse 3. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. And they married Moabite women. One married Orpah and the other Ruth. And they had lived there about 10 years. Now Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. And when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughter-in-law prepared to return home from there. And with her two daughter-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and sat out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. So again, we began with her dealing with transition. Now she's dealing with grief. She's dealing with loss. We understand the enormous hurt of that. And many of you, almost all of us, have experienced it in some level where we've lost somebody that we've loved. But you can see here, imagine losing your husband and then losing both of your sons, and living in a foreign land, and how alone she would feel, and how isolated, and how hurt. Grief causes hurt. And it's necessary for us to find ways to express that grief. But it's also important that we have others around us who are also grieving, and others who are there for us when we grieve. And so we see that with her two daughter-in-laws. We see that with her hearing that things are better back at home, and her desire to go back maybe where family are, to a place that she knows better, and reconnect. Now she's been gone, as we read, for 10 years. So it's been a while since she's been at home and those relationships. But she still is looking for support. She's looking for people that will be there for her. And so we see that need for her to move on. And that's, again, part of grief as well, too. That comes that time that while the pain doesn't all go away, but that's still that time that you've got to move forward. You've got to make other arrangements. You've got to have other plans. You've got to move forward with life. And so, one of the things as a church, and one of the things I'm thankful for with Carol, with our Not Alone ministry that we focus with widows and widowers, is that there are others there to help you. And it's the help to go through that grief process, but it's help also to begin to deal with going forward with life. And one of the things that that they focus on a lot is sharing information about how you do certain things and certain things. And so I've been there with people and knowing how to pay certain bills, knowing how to do certain things with the insurance, knowing how to have your vehicle service, knowing how to have work done at your house, knowing how, for us guys, it may be even more than that, knowing how to wash clothes or cook meals or what do we do or buy groceries or things. And I've talked with people who some of those things, I think about, Darlene does send me to the store every now and then, but that's once or twice a year, usually when I go. And so it's, and my clothes just magically, I wear them, throw them in the hamper, and they just magically appear in my closet again. And so when that quits happening, how do you deal with that? And by the way, she does not let me wash clothes. It's not because I wouldn't. See, I have on occasion. That's why she doesn't let me. So those sorts of things we deal with, and so that it's hard. But you've got to move over. You got to keep living, and so we see all of that here. And one thing that's important in that is a support group. That's what Not Alone tries to be, is that support group for each other. And yet that's what we as a church are. That's why our deacons take our ministry to widows so importantly, because it is an important part of who we are. That's where deacons started in ministry, were to help take care of widows. And so all of those kinds of things are important for us. And it's not just that situation, but whenever anybody has a need, that's part of why the church is there, to help minister and meet and show the love of God to meet those needs. And so that's what we see. And so we see her here in the foreign land, but her realizing that she needs help. And so that help is from God's people. And so she's going to go back home and go and return. And we know the truth too, that there are times when people return to church after they've been out because there's been a hurt, because there's been a need that needs to be made. And so it's a good opportunity for us as a church to meet that need and to minister to that. That's why many things we do with the association are revolved around meeting needs in people's lives. And so those are opportunities for us to share our faith. And so that's an important part of that. And so meeting needs to share faith, and that's something that we do. And we say, and you've heard it said by many people, people don't want to hear how much you love them till you've shown them how much you love them by demonstrating that love to them. So meeting needs is important in reaching people with the gospel. But I also want you to just kind of look at Naomi's life, and we'll look at the rest of the chapter kind of together. And so let's read that together, beginning back in there where we stopped in verse 8. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." And then she kissed them, and they wept aloud, and she said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband, and even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." And as they wept again, then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." And when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. And the two women went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. And I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. And again, that's why it's then associated with the harvest festival. You see, that was set right when that was beginning. So first of all, and we're going to focus Sunday on this idea of a kinsman redeemer. And I just want to remind you, things were different, and they didn't have a social security system. They didn't have a welfare system to take care of widows and others. And the family was responsible for them. But when you've lost your husband and your sons, then there's no family to take care of you. And so for women in those days, there was really no way for them to earn money to live and to sustain themselves. And so even though she's coming back home, there's not that male figure to help take care of her financially. And so they risk starvation, they risk things. And so the method in which they took care of people was what we call the kinsman redeemer. And we're going to talk more about that and focus on that Sunday morning, but I'll just kind of remind you a little bit of what that is. And that is that the young women would marry one of the brothers of their spouse who had died, and they would be responsible, first of all, for taking care of their needs. They would be responsible for fathering children if there were no children. And they would be responsible of redeeming them from debt if they were debtors or had become slaves, or even if they had to sell the land that belonged to the family. And so that kinsman, that family member, was responsible for taking care of those kinds of needs. And Naomi's saying, "I don't have somebody like that. There's not that immediate family member to do that. So you'll be better off if you just go back home to your parents and let them care for you, or some find another husband and let them care for you." And we see that's what one of the daughter-in-laws do. But Ruth is determined to go with her to Bethlehem. And so they come to Bethlehem. But I want you to think with me a little bit about this, about the attractiveness of Naomi's life that made Ruth want to follow not only her, but to follow her God. You see that when she told them to go back, she said, "Go back to your gods." And so they had evidently been some changes in their life as they married her sons and were following the one true God. And so I want you to listen again to those words that we know so well, mainly from weddings and things, again, in that context, but here in this context in the story, to Ruth's reply. The first thing she said is, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back for you. For where you go, I will go." And then she says, "Your people will be my people and your God, my God." So I'm going to go with you. I'm going to stay with you. But the main thing I want you to see is that she wanted to follow Naomi's God because of her relationship with Naomi. And so the question I ask you is this: are the people that you have relationships with, is your life such that they say, "I want to know your God, or I want to follow your God. You know, I talk about the importance of us proclaiming the gospel and telling people the good news and being a verbal witness to people. And I believe God has called us as believers to do all of that. But I often hear people say, well, they just know by my life. And my usual question is then, well, when was the last time somebody asked you about why you live like you live? And if we be truthful, there are only a handful of times that I've ever been asked about, well, why do you do that? Or why do you live that way? Or I've noticed there's something different about you. You know, now we should be that way. You know, remember they talked about the disciples. They said they knew they had been with Jesus by the way that they lived. It should be that way. And there are times it happens. I was talking with one of our young men a couple of weeks ago, and he was excited about a visitor, a friend of his that was supposed to come visit our church. And his comment was, they worked together, and that young man said, I know by the way you act that you must be a Christian. And I know I need to get back in church. I hadn't been to church in a long time. So where do you go to church? Well, don't you wish that we all lived that way? That people saw that difference in us and that difference in our life. And so that's the way Naomi lived. She lived an attractive life, a life that attracted people to the God that she worshipped. You know, too often, our lives, we try to attract people to us, that they would like us. But there was something about the way that Naomi lived that Ruth knew God because of Naomi's life. And so do you live in such a way that your neighbors want to know God because of the way that you lived? So, I mean, that's what she said. I want your God to be my God because of the way you live. And so the challenge to live that way. But also we see that not only did she want to know her God, she also wanted to be part of that community. Because look at what she said. She said, I want your people to be my people. Now, again, we want people to know God first. That's our primary responsibility. And it's not just our church. We're kingdom-minded. We want people that if we're going to reach the river region, we need every church we've got in the river region to help us reach all of the people, you know. And that's why we're excited about these Bible schools that are doing well this week, and little kids that are hearing about Jesus, and we're praying for them. But at the same time, I want us to also be a church that the way we live and how we act in our community attracts people to God, but also attracts them. They should be attracted to us. You know, part of the problem, part of the reason people aren't attracted to God is they aren't attracted to God's people, because we spend too much time fighting. I mean, that's what I was hoping we didn't get distracted down in New Orleans. Spend time fighting amongst ourselves instead of drawing people to us, and more importantly, drawing people to God. But Ruth was attracted to God's people because of Naomi's life. And so, again, hear those words that they told this young man in our church. They said, where do you go to church? Because I see the difference God is making in your life. And so, again, that we live such a life that it brings people toward Jesus, but it also brings people toward God's people. And they see that need. You know, we talk about that. Again, you think about, you know, I think about some people who are part of our church who don't have family members, who we care for as a church because they don't have children or grandchildren or brothers or sisters who can care for them. And there over the years have been several people that would describe. And we are their family for them. But at the same time, think of the people who don't have a church family. You know, I've been there when one of us, a tragedy has happened, and I've seen all the people come to love and to support that family. I've also been in the hospital with somebody who wasn't connected to a church and been there where I've gone to try to love on them and there's nobody else there because they don't have a church family. So it's important that we understand that attractiveness of being there for each other. Something else that was attractive in Naomi's life is the way she dealt with her suffering and grief. And again, we've talked about that before, that all of us are going to have issues and problems in life. But when those problems come, it's often an opportunity for people to see the testimony of your faith, to see your trust in God. You know, when you have that loss, how can you keep going? When you have that, how can you still live with joy while you're going through this painful circumstance? And people see that in our faith. It just flashed in my mind, so I'm going to share that. I spent some time talking with Governor Bob Riley back years ago. After he had lost his daughter. And we talked about faith and faith of politicians and other things. But as we talked about that, we talked about the fact the way that he and his wife embraced faith because of that tragedy in their life. And how there are times when people fall away from God because of tragedy in their life, but there are also times when people grow more spiritually than ever before because of their dealing with that tragedy. And that's what I saw in his wife's life. And that's what we see and can be part of is as we deal with tragedy, it's a great way to testify to people. You know, you think about, you know, we've talked and prayed for that, but you think about the example of Keith Loomis and how he dealt with his cancer and how we watched for 5 years that journey, but how quick he was to glorify God in the midst of that. And think about what a testimony that was to people who weren't believers. I mean, it was great encouragement to us who loved him and were believers and knew where that faith was grounded. But what a testimony to the world, to those who didn't have that faith, to see him respond to such a crisis with that faith. And so I'm sure that was part of Naomi's faith. One of the most famous sermons ever preached was preached by a Scottish preacher who, by the way, his name was A.J. Gossip. And so a preacher who gossip always, I thought was interesting. But he preached a famous sermon that was called "When Life Tumbles In, What Then?" And it wasn't the fact that he preached that sermon and that sermon was so eloquent. It was the fact that he preached that sermon on Sunday morning when his wife had died Saturday night. And the people came to the church not knowing if he was even going to show up, not really expecting him to show up. And as word had just spread around that his wife had died that night, and sure enough, it's time for the service to start, in walks A.J. Gossip. And up behind the pulpit he walks, and then he preaches that sermon on that Sunday. And so how we meet tragedy, how we deal with that. And so there are a couple things in this real quickly that I would point out to you. How do you deal with that? And Naomi mentions Mara, and she mentions the bitterness that she feels. But verse 20, this is important for us. She says, "Don't call me Naomi," she told them, "call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." Now, she called herself bitter. She said, "I've been treated bitter." But as you look at her life, you see that she doesn't live like she's bitter, does she? She's worried about her daughter-in-laws. And we're going to watch as the story unfolds how she takes care of Ruth and focuses not on her own selfish needs, but on others. And so it's important that even when life has treated us bitterly, that we learn to live without bitterness in our life. And you know some people, and that's part of what I was talking to Governor Riley about is some people that when tragedy happens, that they just get bitter. They get mad at God. They get mad at everybody else. They feel like they've been given a raw deal, and so they're just hurt. And we understand that hurt. But you can't go on living your life that way. But instead, it's those people who use it as an opportunity to grow, as people who use it as an opportunity to minister to others. I was spending some time with one of our young couples who had lost a child to miscarriage not long ago. And even just a couple days after that had happened, they began to talk about another family who had gone through a similar experience, one of their friends, who they were going to use their loss to help minister to them. And so it's easy for us to get caught up and selfish in our own rind, but an opportunity for us to use even our heartache to minister to others. You know, one of my good friends, Mike Jackson, who many of you know, Mike's preached here for us before, works at the state convention. You know, we just had the date of his son's suicide of 20 years ago. And I've watched for those last 20 years how this pastor whose son committed suicide because of a drug addiction just watched how he has used that hurt in their own lives to minister to other people, and how he could have been bitter about what had happened, but how he allowed that hurt to empower him to share and comfort other people. The other thing that you see is that they leave the explanation of misfortunes to God. And so in this, she says here, "Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." And she says, that's the word Shaddai, you know, the word El Shaddai that we talked about before. And what it means is protector. And it also means the God of power, the God who nothing is impossible to. And so she didn't buy into the bitterness, but she expresses that her faith, that even when we don't trust God, even when we don't understand why things happened, or even when we trust God, even when we don't understand why things happened. You know, we've sung for 20 or 30 years now the words that Charles Spurgeon actually penned 150 years ago, when he said that when you can't see God's hand, when you can't see God's plan, you trust his heart. Because God loves you. He cares for us. We can trust him. And even when things don't go the way we want them to, we still trust God, that he's the one who's taking care of us. He's the one who's doing it. So when I was talking to that young couple who had just lost this child, you know, we talked about the continuing to trust God, even in the midst of their pain, even in their heartache, that they could still trust God. And then the last thing I'd remind you of tonight is that we leave things in God's hands, but we also look for God to provide what we need. Look at verse 22. So she returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, her daughter-in-law, and they arrived at Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. They didn't have anything, but they get there just in time for the harvest. And so remind you that there is a harvest there, a provision from God who's going to help us no matter what difficulty we deal with. We just trust him and trust his provision for us.